You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
I invite you to join me as we explore new ideas. I'm David Bryan. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. Hey everybody, and welcome to Curiosity Invited, and what a treat for me. I am speaking today with Ashley Wiley Johnson. Ashley Wiley Johnson, PhD. And I should tell you in advance, I know Ashley. I know Ashley from the time she was in the high school that I worked at, and she's just as delightful now as she was then. So thank you, Ashley, for being willing to spend some time and talking about what you do, which I love what you do. So welcome. Welcome.
Thank you, David. I'm so excited to be here. Of course, spending time with you is a treat. And it's been that way since high school.
Yeah, probably sometimes not so, but whatever. Anyway, so I'm going to show my ignorance. You are, well, let's see, I've got it written down, so so Ashley Wiley Johnson. Ashley is a speech language pathologist, an author, an expert on autism, speaker. She is all over the media, especially in the Los Angeles area. She's been on Fox, on KTLA, on MSNBC, yada, yada, yada. And, so she speaks, she practices, and here's my puzzle. So you're the vice president of the Los Angeles Speech and Language Therapy Center. And how did a speech and language pathologist get as interested in autism as you are? Or has that always been an aspect of what speech and language pathology practitioners do?
That's a great question. Yeah, you know, when I was in school learning to become a speech pathologist, you learn everything from, you know, the babies all the way up to geriatrics and strokes and just early intervention. And so when I first started, I actually thought that I was really interested in the voice realm. And so I was like, oh, maybe I want to go and focus on voice work, which voice and speech pathology is a big thing. Like if someone has, you know, a vocal nodule and like counseling. And so I thought that was it. And then it turns out that when I started to actually work with the kids in my mom's practice, which mind you, I grew up around most of them, then I realized that like where I was raised is actually where I was the most, felt the most filled and useful. Mm-hmm. And I will never forget going to a conference where there was a speaker. And in this conference, he was talking about people with autism and he was talking about his group and he kept calling them his guys. And he's like, my guys do da, 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 and my guys are. And so I was like enamored in his speech. And I was like, that sounds so great. And he was talking about social skills development. And like, it was like he had his own quirks as he was talking about what he described as his guys. And I was like, oh, I just was like so all in. And then I realized that like I have this real love for teaching social skills to people. And the funny thing is, the interesting thing is, every time I do a session, I still to this day will tell parents or even like my own clients, like I'm also learning too. And so it just like feels very natural. And so with social pragmatic skill development, that's like a key feature of autism, a lot of neurodiversity, but specifically autism, you'll find that there's some differences in social interaction. And so it's just been that niche that I've really enjoyed. And you know, aside from it, like I mentioned, my mom does it.
And was her focus sort of, what did she work a lot with people on the spectrum, with people with autism? Or
She talks about, like, so she's had, it's now into 47 years, and she talks about 47 years ago, how there was this wave of individuals that were coming out from the mental health facility in Ventura County that they had put people in thinking that they had bipolar disorder. But in all actuality, they realized that these individuals, many of them were savants and also had autism. And so she's seen that full gamut of like the youngest children all the way now. She still works with people that are 30, 35 years old, have autism, but that she just grew with them. So they were babies and she just kept developing programs, kind of seeing what their needs were. And it was really cool to be able to see her kind of just move into this place, so that we become a specialty practice because we have other locations. And with autism now, you know, at the time it was like one in 150. That was one of the, you know, later statistics. And now at this point, it's like one in 31. So of course we're seeing this huge wave of individuals that are coming and the need, and they're coming from all over the world. And my mom just really honed all in, and all of the speech pathologists in our practice are just like all in on it. And it's become a specialty now.
And so I was going to ask you about that. I mean, I remember, well, I don't want to focus too much on the speech pathology piece, but I remember when I was a kid, speech pathologists were more like, they were more like technicians. And now they're more like, I don't know if that's true, but there's more and more sort of relational practice. They work with people on how to create, sustain successful relationships. They're not just technicians. They're not just following some sort of protocol. They're really working with individuals in a richer way. And the other piece about it is, to what do anybody attribute the rise in autism, or at least those numbers you just pointed at, right? That's dramatic. So why? Is it better diagnostics? Is it different diagnostics? How'd that happen?
Yeah. You know, you bring up a great point, because the evolution of speech pathologist, especially because before, everybody would see them as what people would call speech teachers. You know, you always hear about like people in the school, and I couldn't say the R sound, and someone helped me to say it. And
that's still
alive and well placed. But it's like once we've gotten, I think with the advances in the DSM, for example, a diagnostic statistical tool, it's kind of changed the way that people can treat. You know, it's interesting, like I'm seeing speech pathologists are now included in many CPT codes for insurance, along with psychologists and social workers. And so I feel like there's a change in, like, you know, what speech pathologists can do. There's so much that we could do now, and kind of getting to the cognitive realm. And so to that point, then that's like really what a lot of the work is with people with autism. A lot of it is cognitive. Because you might see that a person doesn't have any difference with their speech, while maybe like they might have advanced speech, like speaking at a level that's way more matured. Like I've seen 3 or 4 year olds that are using adult language, and but the therapy comes into play with their ability to connect with others. So while, yes, like you can speak, I don't need to help you make a sentence. I don't need to help you fix the sound. But I do need to help you to learn how to use that language to relate to others, you know? And so on that note, I think that that's where you'll see that speech pathologists are starting to specialize more. And when it comes to autism, that's an interesting question too. That's like a whole nother part. You know, in my experience, what I've seen is I think there's more that people need to understand about it. I am not one that is just going to go off of what's available to you, the information that's available to you. I think people's personal accounts and their experiences are valid. And so what I'm hearing is that there's many different factors that could possibly come into play. While they haven't yet been substantiated, I think they're still important. Like, I want to know more about environmental factors. I want to understand more about some of the genetic connections and correlations. And then I also think as we're learning more, and like I mentioned, that DSM is continuing to evolve. When they took out in the DSM-5, when they took out the presence of speech differences as a diagnostic criteria. So before, you had to have some speech delay, restrictive and repetitive behaviors, and social skills differences. And all of that come up with an autism diagnosis. Now, you have to have restrictive and repetitive behaviors and differences in social impairments, but you don't have to have differences in your language. So when that happened, now you're seeing people
it opened
that
opened up.
So I think that is a big piece for the statistics and why we're seeing more people now get access to an autism diagnosis. And then I think with the different, you know, like the information that's available now in this media age, people are able to look on Instagram and see, oh, this, my son kind of looks like this parent that posted, maybe I should go to the doctor. Or, you know, so I think there's an awareness also growing.
Right. So,
you know, I feel like it's twofold.
Maybe we put the cart before the horse here. So is there a quick and dirty way to define or I'm not asking for the DSM, you know, list, but is there a way to define autism or things on the autism spectrum or the social emotional spectrum? What is it? What is autism?
Okay, so autism is a neurodevelopmental disorder that is marked by differences in social skills and the presence of restrictive and repetitive behaviors. So what that means is, in layman's terms, is that it's an individual that has marked differences in how they interact with others, their ability to capture social cues. Also, you might see some differences in how they interact in terms of their behavior, like a very limited interest or very like restricted, like the child likes cars, but instead of just picking up a car and playing with it, they will just go back and forth. And then they turn their eyes this way and they're going back and forth with the car and they do it over and over and over again. That's an example of like a restricted behavior and also a repetitive behavior. You might see, like, for example, there might be an interest in, you know, objects, and then they line every single one up. And if you take out just one, it's like, no, that's not how it's supposed to go. And so then you'll see that's a restricted interest and a repetitive behavior. And then, you know, there's also this wave of adults that are, you know, getting diagnosis. They're finding that most of them, I'm hearing that adults will say that they'll find that they had some challenges interacting with others for a long time, or maybe having difficulties in the workplace, not connecting with people. Those are all examples of things that could be counted as a difference in social skills and also a presence of repetitive and restrictive behavior.
Yeah. I think you know this, but did you know that we started a spectrum program at New Roads? That there was a program like that? Okay.
There was.
And there still is. There still is. I remember, you know, to my surprise, the variety among this population that were autistic, that had, you know, high functioning human beings diagnosed with autism, the range, the variety was enormous. Mm-hmm. So from the, you know, from a lay person's point of view, from the outside looking in, okay, there was something about all of them, all of the kids, that if somebody told me, okay, well, this person has autism, okay, you know, there's something off here, off, whatever that means, right? Not, quote, normal. But not necessarily like one another, Right. And I mean, is that accurate? I mean, is there just an enormous variety of behavior in the population with autism?
Yeah, absolutely. I always tell people, like, if you've met one person with autism, you've literally met one person with autism.
One person, right.
I've not seen, in my experience, I have never seen two people that have the exact same presentation. Like, you might see, you know, but the diagnosis, it all stands. Like, you know, there's so much change. Like, social skills, that's huge. So one person's challenge or also one person's strength might not be present in another person. I've seen people that can, like, not speak at all, but can communicate using prose and Shakespeare and all sorts of stuff on an AAC device, but they still have autism, you know? And yeah, you're right. It's like, it's a huge range. And that's why it's like, I think that there's a race to try to figure out some sort of commonalities, also to try to figure out how we can help this. But at the end of the day, I don't know if it's that we can't help. I mean, I feel like as I see people, especially with adults that are now, oh, I actually had a late autism diagnosis. I don't know if we can necessarily fix this. A lot of this is people, you know, and differences in people and the presentation.
Yeah. I remember it was to, you know, to the layperson, to me, to person, it was flabbergasting sometimes. I mean, you know, here were kids, high school age people who could do advanced calculus. But if I needed them to go, hey, could you go to 7-Eleven and get change from the guy? Like, that was way too much, but not it wasn't the math that was the problem. It was the, how do I navigate this, when you think about it, this relatively complex situation that I just can't quite puzzle, that they can't puzzle out, right? Like, do I wait in line? Do I just walk up to the head of, like, what do I do here? And what if that person asked me a question? And so it had nothing to do with making change.
Right.
It was just like, oh my God, I don't get it. So, and that was, you know, that was quite something to experience as an experienced educator who supposedly knew kids.
Right.
And then what? Wait, what?
Yeah. So, it's a conundrum. Yeah. For sure. And then, and I feel like we have to know more, like, as the prevalence increases, you know, it's like more and more people are going to be interacting. And especially with targeted therapy, it's like we're finding people with autism, you know, are included. You see them in higher education, in the classroom. They might be the smartest person in the room, but then, like, still have these quirks. Right. And then not to mention a family they can choose at that point. If your language is not impaired, you know, you might choose to have your child go into therapy or not. And so it's like we have to be prepared to deal with that. And I have a feeling it'll be even more, you know, than it was before.
Well, I remember meeting some of the parents for the first time. So there were some students who, well, here, you know, this is, my diagnosis is worth exactly what you're paying for it. Nothing. But there were some students who clearly were autistic. They were not in the program, although they befriended and wanted to hang out with the people in the program. There was definitely a felt sense of recognition and mutuality. And then meeting those parents, you know, and realizing, oh, there's definitely a link, you know, and the dad or the mom, who was, I'm thinking a particular family, who was an incredibly successful Los Angeles lawyer, was so on the spectrum. I mean, he was a bigger version of his kid. And here he was in this high-powered legal situation and doing and thriving, doing just fine. I mean, at least if you measure success by, you know, well, he's supporting a family and he lives in a very good neighborhood and he's, you know, he's a partner in a law firm and blah, 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 blah. But I'm not sure his connections with other human beings were as successful. So it is a really odd and interesting territory. Can we talk a little bit about, you know, some people get diagnosed later. Some people get diagnosed as an infant, I suppose. I don't, how does that happen? And what are the different challenges that happen? Like, you know, if you meet somebody who's 2 years old and you, I mean, I'm assuming it's something, well, no, why should I assume? I have an expert that I'm talking to. Like,
thank you.
What's the youngest a person could be diagnosed with autism?
You know, they say, I mean, okay, so the youngest that someone could be diagnosed can be as early as 18 months of age, as early as 12 months of age. I remember, you know, being at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, when I was doing my undergraduate, and there was like a distinct home video project that would go on where we would look at home videos and be able to track what was the differences. And at that time, it was like camcorder videos. And you could see that, like, the child, you know, maybe had differences in eye contact, or maybe they just weren't connecting, or the social smile, having difficulties with that. And so, like, while you could receive a diagnosis as early as 12, 18 months of age, you do see, and that's what that research was. I was just doing an independent study, but it was like fascinating to me to see that like these babies are 5, 6 months and showing some differences. But then at the same time, you know, like you mentioned, the successful lawyer that maybe does or does not have an autism diagnosis, it's like there's this, like, they may not say it, or they might have had it and gone past it, or, you know, so that type of profile, then usually that's a person that did just enough. You know, everything was just enough to just pass under. And you still see that. And then you'll see like something occurs. So you might see, for example, now we're 8 years old and you're seeing some clear differences in how they interact with others, breakdowns, like the need for some repair. Then, okay, let me come into this point. I've seen people that are 20 that they're like, they go to college and they're like, well, I don't feel like I fit in. And then they go to their, you know, campus psychological center and realize, oh, I actually have autism. And so I think it's very interesting. And then, you know, like a parent's ability to shield and then also to say like, oh, I saw that in my child. I also didn't like to interact with people, or I also never liked things like this, or I always love cars and wheels and that's what I liked, you know, then they'll kind of like child. So, but then on the opposite side, you might see the parent that's literally like, I don't see him smiling. We're like, isn't this kind of weird? He always puts everything in his mouth. Should I just go right now? You know, so it's all about like when the parent does the diagnosis and like starts that process. And ultimately, if they choose to never do it, then they keep going forward, you know, you might be in the school. And then once again, it's like, if your speech is intact and you're in a general class, you're doing fine. There's no reason for a speech pathologist to come in and check in on you. Mm-hmm. You've gone through now a full school situation. And then you never had to have any need to go get a diagnosis, you know? So it just depends.
I remember, like, well, depending upon what kind of a school, I mean, I'm talking about from the point of view of a guy from a school, but depending upon what sort of school a child went to for elementary school. So elementary schools are frequently, not always, but frequently they're warm and fuzzy and supportive of all the kids, and the kids learn all the right ways to be a human being and, you know, all the stuff you were taught in kindergarten that you forget when you're president of the United States. So a kid with autism can move through an environment like that and be fine. It's like sort of be carried through by the warm and fuzziness of it all.
Yeah.
And then they would hit middle school where, you know, we all know middle school can be a challenging time, especially seventh, eighth grade, right? And suddenly this, you know, it's almost like the separations happen and the kids who were in a warm and fuzzy environment are now sort of thrown in, you know, into general population. Mm-hmm. And in the prison yard, right? I mean, and it's a whole different thing. And suddenly it's like, wait, what's going on? And, or somebody makes it to high school and then it's, and I mean, you must see a bunch of that, right? Like, and at least in the education front, but I imagine it carries through in the work front as well. There's a conversation about accommodations, right? I mean, in schools, like, well, this could be successful if a teacher would, whatever the needs are. And so could you talk some about the kinds of accommodations that can shape the environment in a way that makes this person and everybody else successful? But Brett, can you talk about that?
Yeah.
Or am I asking a question that doesn't make sense?
No, you're right. Yeah. You're right. You're absolutely right. And I feel like, you know, it's like it's interesting. The environment is what you make of it. And I do think that with the right setup, individuals that have autism can thrive and continue to be fine throughout their life. You know, accommodations, specifically like a lower class ratio, for example, a smaller classroom size where you have like a easier social situation for some, or you have a teacher who is very focused on including everybody, or a school that's extremely inclusive. Like, you know, I still talk about how there'd be people in our class that had differences and they were all like a part of the community. And like a valid part of the community. And then like I could actually build friendships with these people that maybe if I was at a public school with 150 people in my class, I may not feel like I needed to connect with this person.
Right.
Or maybe I would feel like not cool, you know? So right. I feel like in some settings, and that's why I loved, you know, what's happening at New Roads with the Spectrum program, because it's like it just makes this, you just feel super included. You know, and so the only thing I would think for accommodations is inclusion. Also, like situations like, for example, like there's some of these nowadays, like there's some of these academies that are more like online, for example, a person who like doesn't want to have to interact with others, then that would be great. Like they could thrive in that type of setting. Cause it's like, oh, I got straight through. I was able to engage and, you know, did what I needed to do, show up where I need to show up and I'm successful. You know, so there's several settings. And I mean, understanding and awareness is another piece of it too. Like, I remember talking with an educator that was actually at New Roads, and she was talking to me about someone that was there at the school and how like the parents took him out of the environment for like a year. And he couldn't even make a whole year of being away because he was so included in his school that he was not successful when he got pulled out and the parents came right back, because it's like he seems so typical in this setting at New Roads. He seems so typical. And then they were like, oh, great. Well, we could go try somewhere else. And then they tried somewhere else and failed miserably and came right back, you know? So it's kind of like, I'm kind of like, if you find something also, like, what's the need to fix it? If you find something that works, you know, like go ahead and let that person continue on the trajectory until they have to experience change. You know, changes can be really challenging for someone that's neurodiverse, especially somebody that has autism.
Was there some, oh, because of the social, I get it. I was about to ask a really stupid question.
Yeah. No, it's not. No question, stupid.
Oh, no, no. You don't know my questions. It can be really stupid.
Well, curiosity is invited, David.
Yeah, exactly. Thank God.
Right.
And what about, do you work with, or folks in your in the center, do you work with adults? I mean, because I know one of the things on many parents' minds when their kids are diagnosed with autism is, or when they're neurodiverse in a variety of different ways, there is the anxiety of thinking, hey, chances are I'm going to go before my child goes, and what will happen to my child then, right? If I die and I've got a kid who's diverse in that way and struggles in those ways, and I was involved in the support, and then I'm not there, that's got to be like this thing that is like hanging over people's heads. They're like, wait, what do we do? What do we do? And what do we do just to help somebody be more independent? Because parents want that. And it's, you know, parents want that, and human beings need that frequently.
100%.
So, yeah.
You like,
it's
totally
hard.
You're totally mentioning something that's like a right now thing, you know, because you're right. So when I think about, for me, as a therapist, everything for me is about helping the client become independent as they can be, for right. that reason that, like, right. for example, you know, now I'm seeing, like, it's funny, there's waves. So the first group of individuals that really have received targeted therapy all across their life probably is around late 20s, early 30s, age wise. Now, as therapy is getting stronger and more variety and more access, and people are more knowledgeable about resources, then we see, like, for example, the clients that I have that are now 18. You ask them, what do you want to do? I want to go to college. I want to live by myself. I want an apartment. Some of them might want a husband, wife, a children. So valid things that these individuals want, they're just like anyone else. And so I find that the programs that we develop are all about helping them to become more independent. So, like, for example, I'm noticing that you wouldn't usually think of people that have autism. Many times they're worried, the parents might be worried, like, can my child or young adult even go out on a Friday night, you know, can they have fun and hang out with people? But you're seeing that the individual now is like, I want to have fun. I want to get out. I want to do this by myself. And so, like, one of the newest programs that we have is a program that is called Community Conquerors. And the reason why was because I saw in the kids that, like, they need to have something to do on the weekend. But they don't necessarily have the skills to plan as clearly as possible as maybe a neurotypical person would. You know, those text messages, thinking about what you're going to do, communicating with others, identifying people that you'll go out with, you know, and like building your community. And so this program, the only goal is to help them to think about what you'd like to do in the community, plan out all the steps. Now the therapy session's over. We've dropped you at this location, and now you do it by yourself.
Well,
therapy's over. My mom, who has like had many years of this, is like, no, I don't know if they could do that. I don't know. Because her wave of adults that are now like 30 something, they're still a little bit more sheltered. So I'm of the thought that, like, we need to really try to help. If you have this therapy, if you're able to get out, you deserve to have a social life just like anyone else. Let me help you get those tools. And I think it's important. You know, she just started an independent living program focusing on, you know, learning the skills, the cooking, the cleaning, the laundry. reason why she's doing it is because she has more clients right now that are like, I want to live by myself. I don't want to be. I want to live by myself. And the point I'll make too is, you know, I think about my aunt that's in Wisconsin, my cousin, Blake, he's 30. And it's the thing right now that we're planning for is like, what is going to be his future? They're thinking, well, they want to be able to buy a duplex and set things up so that he can have someone living in with him. But everything is set. Maybe it's another individual with special needs that's in this duplex next to him, because they know, like, when we go, what's going to happen? And so my newest interest, I think, has been also thinking about independent living. Like, how can we support, you know, you deserve an apartment. You deserve a house if that's what you want. You deserve to go to the college and live in the dorm rooms and not come home every day, you know? And so I feel like it just takes us being mindful and thoughtful and also just like hearing their desires and coming up with ways to support them. So I'm really excited about, like, you know, in California, we have so much. Wisconsin has like self-determination programs where it's like you get a bucket of money and you can plan what the life looks like. You know, another big piece of our work is employment. So for example, like some days I'm at a CVS store helping an individual figure out what are the things that you need so that you can stock the items, engage in customer service, and do this activity so that you can now have a job. You know, people with autism have the lowest unemployment rate of all of the disabilities, because it's an invisible disability. And then, of course, too, with those social skills differences, it's hard to not only get the job, but then once you get the job, you have to keep the job.
And so, do you run into all sorts of resistance from potential employers?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not exactly resistance. It's lack of knowledge. Like, you know, sure, we have lots of people with disabilities here working here. But then it's like, okay, well, are you actually including this person? Or like for a person with autism, you might be talking to someone that can be the pharmacist in the store or someone that could be the manager. Like they're not going to just bag the items. They have the ability. Right. And so then it's like, and then if you don't tap in to what their ability is, ultimately you're going to see the person's going to lose, you know, their will to want to be there, or they'll be there and just in this mundane space. And so while we're helping individuals learn how to work in the workplace, we're also helping the workplace to be ready to receive them so that it's a safe and welcoming space that also encourages pushing them to the limits so that you can reach limit potential, you know? So I don't see resistance. I just see limited knowledge.
What's and gosh, as you were speaking, it's, you know, I was getting chills because it's super important, specifically because, like, you know, the numbers you were talking, like, there's a lot of people coming through the pipe that are going to need exactly that sort of support. And if not, what are they going to do? Right. And what are we as a society going to do? Has the change in the government administration at the federal level or otherwise changed what you have to deal with, what you, therapist, what you have to deal with respect to programs? I mean, are there programs, you know, as DOGE was going through hacking up the world, did their axe fall on things that were relevant to this population?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, with the big, beautiful bill and healthcare. Sorry.
Wow. That is exactly how I feel about that.
He's upset about it. Okay, I'm back.
I just figured RFK walked in your house and your dog just did exactly the right thing.
Right. So interestingly enough, while yes, like there's been healthcare changes, there's been cuts, there's been things that are going on, time bound, what we're approved for, what we're allowed to bill for, what we're not allowed to bill for, more from the healthcare perspective. But for the first time in this administration, autism has a spotlight because from the beginning, you know, Trump mentioned that this is a priority to him. So we're actually talking about autism, and we weren't talking about it before. So it has an interesting spotlight. Now there's also this, like, because of this, I'm seeing a rise in the people that are like, there's a cure for this. And so, you know, with that being said, then there's this quickness. Okay, we want to introduce certain medicine, for example. Leucovorin has come into play. People are taking more, and you kind of saw this with ADHD when there was like this huge spike. Then everybody was like, oh, Ritalin, this is what we have to do, is, you know, we're going to start taking these things and help the kids. So I'm seeing that. I'm seeing more parents ask me about like specific drugs to help their child who has autism. And then on top of that, I'm seeing parents are also citing this research that's coming out. They're citing a lot of research, and parents are saying, should I take this drug, or, you know,
or should I avoid this drug?
I avoid it. Yeah. And then like the studies that are coming out from the administration might include like one person. And then they're like, oh, this is for everyone. Like the Tylenol crisis, like that study that came out caused all these issues. More and more parents were like upset. If they had a kid who had autism already, they were upset because they were like, I didn't even take autism. I didn't take Tylenol. My kid doesn't, you know. But then you look at this study, and we're maybe talking about 15 kids total.
Right. Exactly.
And none of the kids were Black. Nobody was Hispanic. Nobody was, it was a very like Eastern Europe group of population of people that they're referencing this. And so, you know, it caused a big problem. I'm glad Tylenol shut that down very quickly. But it's just like, I guess it's that. So as I'm talking about, I guess it's the fake news, right? That's come up. And that's where we're seeing the biggest impact. And so then it's like turning to where we have to be like, no, like this is actually like, there weren't that many people that were included here. Don't worry about this. I don't know about that, you know? And then not to mention just being like a source of like letting a parent feel comfortable to just say like, I can't believe that now I'm being blamed for this, you know, because of choices that I'm making. So I'm feeling like we're doing more therapy with the parents too than with the individual.
Well, I can't imagine that. I imagine that that's always right. I mean, supporting people through whatever it is, because people live in some sort of community, however big or small, it's you're supporting all of that, right? It's because the community affects the individuals. So the parents are affected, the kids are affected, the adults, blah blah, the so-called neurotypical people are affected.
Right.
You just mentioned something interesting that I know nothing about. Are there differences having to do with neurotypical, neurodivergent situations, diagnoses, autism, when it comes to different populations? So you just made reference to the Black community. Is it different in the Black community? I mean, care may be different. Like, what? So tell me about that. Educate me.
Yeah.
Curiosity, yeah. Me.
Right. Okay. You know, does autism look different in the Black community? It looks different in terms of access to resources and access to diagnosis. And so Black children are known to be able to receive a diagnosis later than like a white child, for example. Maybe you will see that the number will be around 18 months, right? They're getting access to this diagnosis. But a Black child may not get it until 8 or 9 years old. So they receive it later. They also might have a misdiagnosis. So there's like an influx of people in California. They made this provisional category at the regional centers. The reason was because there were kids who were told that they had no diagnosis, but then you give them a little bit of time and you see a difference and they actually do have a diagnosis. And so because of this disparity, which is like a huge thing in California, I mean, it's all over. The disparity is huge all over the country, but California has put like a laser focus on it. Then they're being able to do certain like safe holds to make sure that we don't just say, well, this person doesn't have anything, this child doesn't have anything, keep going, you know, when in all actuality they had autism. And then
is that because Well, do you know? Is that because, you know, there are certain stereotypes that are incorrect about, well, black kids are, you know, well, frequently black kids have different behavior, right? They're more trouble. They're blah, 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 whatever it is. Okay. And so it gets attributed to something else.
See, look at, that's exactly it. So for example, oppositional defiance, that was a big difference. You might say this child has oppositional defiance disorder, but in all actuality, they had restrictive and repetitive behaviors, differences in social skills, that was actually an autism diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense, you know, so like, so you're right. It's like, oh, like nothing's wrong with him. No, that's just how he's acting. You know, the mom doesn't have da 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 da. Or,
black kids are always more rambunctious or, all that.
And then there's this part that's like the onus that is also shared onus in terms of, you know, black people in general have been not as trusting when it comes to research. And so then, you know, we're not willing to just put our child out there and include them in these studies. Mm-hmm. And so you're seeing that the data is not including a lot of black children. And so it's important, you know, the inclusion in research of people of color is going to be something that's really important. And so I'm always like advocating for families that if it seems safe to go ahead and support this study so that we can have more children in, because we don't know. We don't know what, if there really is a big difference, because we're not, there's not enough black children in the data.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's, you know, this is the perfect because we're leading, I'm looking at time. And I also know one of the things that's really clear is that this is a complicated, a multi-tentacled situation. There's a lot of different factors interacting. And so just the bringing the awareness of that to more and more people is super important. And I get to plug, you get to plug, you also started a podcast. So you want to talk about that for a little bit? Because I think that's just great. That's so important.
Yeah. You know, I think the importance of bringing awareness and the importance of also like humanizing so that people feel comfortable to be, it's okay to be different. It's okay to have a child that looks a little different than someone else. And that difference doesn't mean that they will not be successful. In fact, here's some stories of people that have been, you know, and that's basically.
And it's important, just to be able to talk about it, right? I mean, which people so often shy away from. I don't want to say the wrong thing. I don't want to say something stupid. I don't want to offend somebody. I don't want to hurt somebody's feelings. And so we're not going there. And talk about not inclusion, right? I mean, how do you get included if nobody even is willing to touch the territory?
Yeah, that's the thing. And so I was, you know, as I'm like learning so much about autism and in my professional work, I also felt like with this podcast, the real focus was to, you know, learn about autism, keep talking to people, but find out more about like the day-to-day life. How have you used your differences to be able to live your life? And what are those differences, quite candidly? What does it look like for you in your house? And so we did that, you know, not just for autism, but for different things like osteogenesis imperfecta, which is a rare bone disorder that I only knew about from just seeing individuals. But there's a show on TLC called Jay and Pamela. And this was a story that I was like so enamored by, because it's like they had osteogenesis imperfecta, but they found each other online, and then they went on a path of, you know, dating, getting married, becoming independent, living away from their families. And one of the guy, like the what, so Jay, the one person in that relationship of Jay and Pamela, Jay also has autism, and he has osteogenesis imperfecta. So understanding that story of like, what does that actually look like? Okay, so yeah, we see this on television, but do you guys live by yourself, or are there people living with you, or are you really independent? You know, I loved the conversation with Armani Williams where we talked with the first NASCAR driver with autism, and he was the first person that really broke down. Like, you see this love of transportation, wheels, interest in it, and he literally took that and then became one of the best drivers for NASCAR. And he sat there and he's like, well, I've always loved cars. And I'm like, yeah, okay. You know, like you fought. And so I was really into
That's
those
great.
Sports. Mm-hmm. And so we decided to like diversify a little bit, look at other disorders, not just autism, and then bring it into play. Like we talked with somebody in regards to, you know, fluency disorders, a stutterer. And like, well, what is your sex life if you have a fluency disorder? Do you experience disfluencies in your intimate relationships? What is that like? You know? And so most people don't feel comfortable in a therapy desk. We're really not talking about that. I'm talking about the skills that I need to help you be successful. But this was my chance, along with my colleague, to be able to like unpack it a little bit more and learn more. And so it was interesting at the end of it, as we got through this first season, we found that like people are just out here living, thriving, and like people that will look at their differences, but more see it as like positive things. I loved how Jay talked about like how he had restrictive interest. And he said, well, once I figured out that I wanted to be with her, you know, I'm all in on everything. So I'm like way focused. So I was like, okay. Like, so it was really, really cool to see how like some of these differences presented in disorders actually help people to differentiate themselves and do some amazing things.
But you got to nail it down here. The podcast is called, and who's your co-host?
Okay.
And how can people find it? And I will make sure it's in the show notes and all that. But so talk about it.
Yeah, it's called Deeper Than a Disorder.
Deeper Than a Disorder.
You can find it wherever you find your podcast is where you'll find the full audio version. And then on a weekly or biweekly basis, every other week, we release an episode on YouTube, which is just the interview only, and that's video.
And interview only. What else is there other than the interview?
So there's the interview. There's also a portion where people wrote in and asked us questions about their thoughts and their understanding different disorders or even family members impacted, or stories about dating a person with autism. How do I deal with this? You know, there's also words of wisdom where we go into and talk about things that have inspired us. And so there's about five different segments in the show, but the main part of it is the interview. And that interview lives on YouTube. And I did it with my friend, Dr. George Castle. He is a professor at NYU. And George is like in all the technical details. So it works really well because he will like follow up with some like actual research fact that add validity to what we're doing. And then not to mention, we have been friends since like forever, both as speech pathologists, connected a long time ago. And so it's been great to be able to see, you know,
us deeper than a disorder. That's great. That's cool.
Yeah, I'm excited. And I, you know, I'd love anybody to follow and like and subscribe. We're
absolutely
on Instagram and all those things.
Do you also have an Instagram thing that promotes it that way, or Facebook or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have an Instagram. We have a TikTok.
If you send me all these things, I will make sure they're in their liner notes.
David, you know, I like was the most excited about this interview than any other interview I've done, because I actually get to talk to someone who like really knows me, and you've seen me in this formative place, you know, which is like such an interesting. And so I'm just like so happy, and I would love to do a collaborator post. You know, I'm fangirling for sure.
Cool. Well, me too. Well, Ashley Wiley Johnson, what a treat. What a treat checking in after this time. And how great that your professional interest has sort of like blossomed in this way, or is blossoming in this way. And so, thank you so much.
Look, you laid the first little seed. You were one of those early, early seed layers, and I'm just honored to be able to be here with you. And I hope I'm, you know, like all of my other peers, making you proud.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryant here on LA Talk Radio.